Hello and welcome back. In the previous lecture, we looked at how the Greeks and the Romans relaxed. What we did not factor into that discussion was how sex and sexuality fitted into the picture. Given the sensitivity around this topic today, it's inevitable that it is going to take us into territory where, in some cases, we think and act very differently from the ancients. So, investigating such a sensitive area of human experience requires in itself extreme sensitivity. Though we know infinitely more about the sex lives of the Greeks and the Romans than we do about any other ancient Mediterranean people through their rich body of literature especially, other cultures have provided us with revealing visual information, though visual information alone sheds only a very fitful light upon norms of societal behaviour. A spectacular example is an Etruscan sarcophagus of the mid-4th century in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. On the lid, there is a depiction of a marriage bed on top of which a husband and wife, both naked, embrace. It's an extraordinary testimony to the best of what the afterlife can offer, simply being in bed with one's wife. Neither the Greeks nor the Romans have left us anything as sexually explicit in a major artistic medium, though there are countless examples in the minor arts. The sarcophagus also celebrates marital union in a way that is pretty much unique to Etruscan culture. The afterlife, it's saying, holds no better joy than eternal lovemaking. As I shall try to demonstrate, preferred forms of sexual activity, even sexual preference itself, are intimately related to societal norms and expectations. It's inevitable that we're going to range somewhat randomly over time and place. That in itself is somewhat problematic, as if there weren't important changes taking place in this area of human experience, as in all others. There's a widely held misconception that the Greeks and the Romans were completely open and uninhibited about sex and sexuality, and that they had absolutely no hang-ups about sex. Now, that simply isn't true. They may not have had the same hang-ups as we have, but they had them nonetheless. The word for the private parts in Greek is eidoia, literally the shameful things. In Latin, it's pudenda, which means much the same. That suggests a certain coyness about the human body. And it's also noteworthy that although there were plenty of obscene words in both languages, sexual terms were rarely used as swear words in the way we use four-letter words in swearing. Their use was much more restricted. They might be employed in a formal curse, for instance, or in a magical spell. Well, sexuality is a word for which there is no Greek or Roman equivalent. In fact, one of the most influential studies of sexuality in antiquity is explicitly entitled Before Sexuality. It's edited by David Halperin, John Winkler and Frommer Zeitling, and it carries the subtitle The Construction of Erotic Experience in the Ancient Greek World. No such investigation has been carried out into Roman sexuality, but the book's premise that the study of sexuality, I quote, provides a special opportunity to test our assumptions about what aspects of our lives might truly be common to all human beings and what aspects are distinctive to the modern world, well, that applies equally to all pre-modern societies. Or, to quote Geoffrey Henderson's rather more blunt phrasing, every human society invents the idea of male and female for itself and so defines a workable sexuality. It follows that sex and sexuality is a highly charged and at the same time highly controversial area of investigation with profound and far-reaching implications for human identity itself. My approach to it rests on the assumption that our primary objective is not to pass judgment upon the Greeks and the Romans, however offensive their sexual practices may be in our eyes or anyone's eyes or some people's eyes, but rather to understand them. Their societies operated quite simply on very different lines from ours, with different value systems, a different model of the human personality, indeed a different vision of what it means to be human. We will inevitably discover that the Greeks and the Romans are much closer to each other in their sexual attitudes and practices than either of them is to us, precisely because their societies manifested strong similarities that they do not share with ours. Some words of caution about the unrepresentative and partial nature of our evidence. Most of what we know about this subject comes to us through the filter of freeborn males, whether in their capacity as writers or as artists. As a result, our sources focus overwhelmingly upon male sexuality and hardly at all upon female sexuality, with a further disproportionate emphasis upon homosexual practices over heterosexual practices. Two exceptions to this rule, one Greek and the other Roman, are the poetesses Sappho, 7th century BC, female poet, but actually also a lesbian, and Sulpicia, late 1st century AD, both of whom speak openly of their sexual desire. I'll be talking a bit more about both of them later. It goes without saying that what we know next to nothing about is the sex lives of slaves, other than the fact that whether male or female, they served, when called upon to do so, the desires of their owners. Equally, we know next to nothing about the sexual proclivities of the many peoples who constituted the Roman Empire, Greeks excepted. Our exploration will be based on evidence drawn primarily from literature, art, and to a lesser degree, law. I'd like to turn next to some of the characteristics that the Greeks and Romans shared in common. First, the performing of a sexual act was not purely defined by sexual desire. Referring to Athens' David Halperin in 100 Years of Homosexuality and Other Essays on Greek Law, writes, I quote, "Sexual behavior did not so much express inward dispositions or inclination. It served to position social actors in the places assigned to them by virtue of their political standing in the hierarchical structure of the Athenian polity." End of quote. Whereas we consider asymmetrical relationships involving someone senior with someone junior to be reprehensible, especially if there is a difference in status, as in the case of, say, a professor and a student, the Greeks and the Romans thought very differently. Sex and sexuality in their eyes was very much about power relationships and thus about inequalities. And number one, in terms of gender inequality, there was a belief in the superiority of the male. And number two, in terms of emotional attachment, there was a belief that one party was the lover and the other the beloved, one the hunter and other the hunted. In terms of the age difference, both heterosexual and homosexual relationships were typically formed by individuals separated by at least a decade in years. And fourth, finally, in terms of sexual roles, the senior partner, in terms of age and status, would be expected to take the active dominant role, whereas the junior partner would take the passive subservient one. The second similarity is that both the Greeks and the Romans had no qualms about representations of the male organ being displayed openly in public. And this runs somewhat counter to the linguistic point I mentioned earlier about inhibitions in relation to words describing genitalia. It had much to do with the fact that the male organ symbolizes not just potency, but also fertility. It also had the power to ward off evil. In the Greek world, giant phalli were carried in processions in honor of the god Dionysus. Ithyphallic herms, pillars, that is, surmounted by heads of the god Hermes and provided with erect penises, these stood at street corners in Athens as a sort of protection, and probably in other parts of the Greek world as well. Seems very odd to us, but nonetheless, they were accepted as a normal part of civic life, so to speak. Oversized phalluses were also worn by actors in Aristophanic comedy. In the Roman world, giant phalli advertised brothels, just as in this country, giant candy cane poles once advertised barbers' shops. The male organ was also commonly portrayed in the minor arts. On a related topic, both peoples welcomed highly explicit depictions of sexual intercourse, on vases in particular. Sexual scenes were depicted on both Greek and Roman pottery, and in the case of the Romans, even on humble terracotta lamps, which means that these kinds of objects were very commonly available in the home. In fact, the scenes of lovemaking that we find on Greek vases, especially those of the late Archaic and early Classical period, are unique in their explicitness. And at least as far as Western art is concerned, they just have no parallel elsewhere from any period. Sexual scenes also decorated the rooms of private houses in the Roman world, and indeed of changing rooms in public baths. Third, both the Greeks and the Romans exhibited what we would consider a kind of primness in regard to the naked female body. It was virtually impossible to praise a woman for her beauty without at the same time impugning her chastity. In the poems of Homer, women are praised for the comeliness of their ankles, their arms, and their cheeks, but never for their legs, their breasts, or their buttocks. When the Trojan elders catch sight of the drop-dead gorgeous Helen on the ramparts in the Iliad, they comment very vaguely about her beauty, but they don't describe the face that launched a thousand ships in Christopher Marlowe's haunting phrase. Even Aphrodite, the goddess of sex and sexual love, is described not as ample-bosomed or possessed of juicy thighs, but very primly as laughter-loving and golden. Much the same was true of the Romans. Even in erotic Latin poetry, women come across as little more than a hazy blur. A lesbia, to whom Catullus dedicated some of the most explicit love poems ever conceived, is a complete visual blank. And much the same is true of Cynthia, the beloved of the poet Propertius. We don't need to try to answer the question to what extent these are fictional or real women. The point is that it was not deemed appropriate to delineate, even in language, the female form. Of the Carthaginian queen Dido, one of literature's most memorable creations of a woman, Virgil tells us absolutely nothing other than the fact that she was golden-haired. And even this tantalizing detail is not vouched to the reader until her death scene. There does, however, seem to have been a difference between Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, and her Roman equivalent, Venus. Whereas the former was frequently portrayed as sex personified, her Roman counterpart was often perceived in a more maternal aspect. Venus was, after all, the mother of Aeneas, and thus the mother of the Roman race, Venus genetrix, Venus the giver of birth. And so it behooved the Romans to treat her with proper reverence. Virgil, in fact, assigns Venus an important role in the Aeneid, though her persona is one which is a blend of the erotic and the maternal, and it's distinctly unsettling. When we first encounter her, she assumes the guise of a huntress and flirts quite provocatively with her son Aeneas, only revealing her true identity to him as she departs. Art tells pretty much the same story as literature. Whereas the nude male was an acceptable subject of Greek sculpture from the late 7th century BCE onwards, it wasn't until the Hellenistic period that statues of naked women entered the canon. And when they did, they were to be read overtly, at least as representations of the goddess Aphrodite, rather than of flesh and blood women. Many centuries later, European artists would resume that tradition by depicting mythological rather than real-life nudes. And there are many, many examples of that, particularly, say, from the Renaissance period. It was the sculptor Praxiteles who was commissioned to sculpt the first female nude, probably sometime in the 360s BC. The commission came from the people of Kos, an island just a couple of miles from the Turkish coast, opposite Bodrum. Pliny the Elder tells us that when the sculptor presented them with his sculpture, supposedly modelled after a famous prostitute called Phryne, the islanders were so shocked that they declined to accept it and ordered a draped version instead. The nude in question was purchased by the people of Cnidus, a city on the mainland opposite Kos, instead. And by accepting it, we're told, the Cnidians greatly enhanced the fame of their city, or perhaps the notoriety of their city, which is probably what they intended. The anecdote tells us a great deal about attitudes towards female nudity. And the Romans, of course, adopted the nude as an artistic form from the Greeks. Men, by contrast, were depicted naked, frequently in Rome in the guise of warriors, holding weapons or, in the case of the emperor, holding the thunderbolt of Jupiter. Women, however, invariably in Rome took the guise of the goddess Venus. There were no sculptural female nudes of real-life women in either artistic tradition. Fourth, neither the Greeks nor the Romans permitted the young to engage in premarital sex, at least not with their freeborn counterparts. It was perfectly acceptable for a young man to have intercourse, however, with a slave or with a prostitute. Indeed, it was probably expected. Contrastingly, the stain upon a girl's reputation, if she lost her virginity before marriage, would have been ineradicable. No self-respecting male, either Greek or Roman, would marry a girl who wasn't a virgin. Similarly, there was a much higher expectation that a woman would be faithful to her husband than vice versa, although, as we shall see later, from the late Republican period onwards, women did enjoy much more sexual freedom than they had done previously in Roman society. Our earliest glimpse of husband and wife in ancient Greece is provided by the Odyssey. And the contrast in behaviour between Odysseus and Penelope in sexual matters could not be more pronounced. Penelope, for a period of 20 years, has had to ward off the advances of 108 suitors. Odysseus, by contrast, spends 7 years with the nymph Calypso and another year with the witch Circe. Clearly, a double standard operated. Adultery was a serious offence in both societies, but only in the case of a woman, not that of a man. The fear was that an adulterous wife would produce illegitimate children, thereby undermining the line of succession. And the Romans were as sensitive to this issue as the Greeks. Julius Caesar divorced his wife Pompeia without any proof of her adulterous behaviour when she became the subject of scandal, memorably remarking that Caesar's wife must be above suspicion. Fifth point of comparison, sexual desire, so far as we can determine, was presented, at least in literary terms, as something that lay outside the bonds of marriage. It certainly isn't clear in the Odyssey whether Odysseus feels much sexual desire for Penelope after his 20 years' absence, although it is clear they are very happy to be reunited. Homer merely states, when they are reunited, that they return to their old established pattern of doing things, which could mean anything. Married eroticism is almost wholly absent from literature, but a conspicuous exception are the poems of Sulpicia, whom I mentioned earlier, and who, according to a fellow poet called Martial, wrote love poems addressed to her husband, Calenus, that are both highly sensual and that celebrate what Martial calls chaste and faithful love. Martial's own epigram on Sulpicia was written on the occasion of her death after 15 years of happy wedlock. Let's now turn to some of the areas where there were marked differences between the two societies. First, male nakedness. I've already talked about the nude in art, but social practice is something quite different. For the Greeks, it was quite acceptable for a man to display himself naked before other men, particularly in a religious context. Male athletes practiced naked at the gymnasium. The word means the place of nakedness, and they also performed naked at the festival games. They did so out of respect to the gods. Alexander the Great processed naked around what he thought was the tomb of Achilles, similarly as a mark of homage to the dead. The Romans, by contrast, regarded male nakedness as shameful and degrading, and that was the reason why they very rarely participated in Greek athletics when it involved competing in the nude. Cicero quotes a line from the Roman epic poet Ennius to the effect that stripping is the origin of vice. Roman resistance to nudity is perhaps one of the reasons why there is no Roman equivalent to Apollo, the god who was depicted in the guise of a naked youth at the peak of his physical prowess. Second, homosexuality. I'm going to give particular attention to this topic because it figures so prominently in our sources. And that's largely because elite males tended to regard it as a superior form of emotional attachment, and because elite males happen to have left testimonies to their beliefs. Overall, the Greeks regarded homosexuality predominantly as an episodic phenomenon, something that is that belonged to a particular period of one's life, rather than as we do, as a permanent orientation. A number of Greek communities, including those in Boeotia in central Greece, Elis and Sparta in the Peloponnese, and the islands of Crete, made pederasty a rite of passage that led to adulthood. Now, somewhat similarly, Plato, in his dialogue called The Symposium, which is dated around 385 BC, condones, even extols, pederasty so long as it has a pedagogical objective. For him, it is the ideal mentoring relationship. And for him too, the sexual aspect is merely incidental. Pederasty aside, there can be no doubt that the Greeks in general considered same-sex relations to be entirely normative. Even so, we should not overgeneralize. In Homer's Iliad, the closest relationship is between Achilles and his male friend Patroclus, but there isn't the slightest whiff of this being a homoerotic affair. On the contrary, Homer presents quite simply a moving tribute to male bonding. It's also the case that homosexual relations were not expected to replace heterosexual relations. Rather, they were intended to supplement them. Those who committed themselves exclusively to homosexual acts were mocked and vilified, as we see from the abuse that was heaped upon such effeminates as they were regarded in the plays of Aristophanes. Mainstream Roman culture was far less comfortable with homosexuality. Even the words that the Romans commonly employed to describe it are expressive of their unease, as we see from the term uti graeco, to indulge in Greek sexual practices, or more literally, to do what Greeks do, meaning to indulge in a homosexual act. This suggests that the Romans sought to distance themselves from what they officially and collectively regarded as effeminate and degenerate behavior. And so too, lots of the words used to describe male homosexuals were loanwords from the Greek. And similarly, one of the principal charges that was repeatedly leveled against politicians to blacken their reputation was that of being the passive partner in a homosexual relationship, the point being that only a social inferior would tolerate such an indignity. Now, Julius Caesar, for instance, even when he reached the pinnacle of power, never managed to live down the rumour that early on in his career he had been the catamite of Nicomedes, king of Bithynia. In fact, he was still being taunted for it 30 years later by his veterans, who chanted scurrilous verses to this effect as they celebrated his triumphs in 45 BC. Was the charge true? We don't know, but it was entirely plausible given the fact that Caesar was a thoroughly Hellenized Roman, like all elite Romans of his day. Well, to propose that Hellenization included the adoption of sexual practices that were particularly closely associated with the Greeks may seem somewhat far-fetched, but all the same, it's likely to be true. Hellenization was a propensity for all things Greek. In fact, The Greek historian Polybius, writing around the middle of the 2nd century BC, talks disparagingly of young Romans who were prepared to pay a talent for a male prostitute and 300 drachmas for a jar of pickled fish from the Black Sea. So they're taking on two aspects of Hellenization, both the taste in food and also the sexual proclivities as well. His point is that the bad consequences of Hellenization, namely succumbing to a Greek propensity for debauchery, to which he himself is completely opposed, could be utterly ruinous. From the late Republican period onwards, Roman women of social distinction, including later members of the imperial household, became sexually liberated in ways that would have been unthinkable in any other period of either Greek or Roman history. And this is one of the most interesting features of a change in sexual practices in the ancient world. Lesbia, the girlfriend of the poet Catullus, I mentioned earlier, who gave her younger lover such a runaround with innumerable partners, is just one example, though we have to be careful, of course, not to treat poetry as fact. Another example is Messalina, the wife of the Emperor Claudius, who had a reputation for being a nymphomaniac. Though we should be careful not to buy into all the rumour mongering, the evidence for the fact that women were enjoying more sexual freedom is overwhelming. There's no clear explanation for this trend, although it was a fact that Roman society was becoming increasingly cosmopolitan, which resulted in a certain relaxation of social mores. Ancient authors have left us an incredibly rich and diverse body of literature about sexual desire, and it's that to which I'd like to turn finally. One of the greatest exponents is Sappho of Lesbos, who wrote with haunting precision of the physical effects of unrequited love. I quote, "Whenever I look at you, I seem not to be able to utter a word. I become tongue-tied. A fire penetrates my skin. I can't see anything clearly, and there's a thundering in my ears. I break out in a cold sweat. My whole body shudders. My complexion becomes paler than grass, and I seem to be on the verge of death." End of quote. Moving to the classical period, comic writers such as Aristophanes make sexual desire a subject of uproarious hilarity. The plot for his Lysistrata, for instance, is built on the premise that the Peloponnesian War will come to a grinding halt if wives deny husbands their sexual favours, because their husbands will become incapable of thinking about anything else. They won't be able to fight any longer. In a more serious vein, the tragedian Euripides in the Hippolytus explores the devastating effects of an older woman's fatal passion for her stepson. What complicates the plot is that Hippolytus prides himself on his unyielding commitment to celibacy. Within the mythological framework in which Euripides sets the drama, Hippolytus rejects Aphrodite in favour of her diametrical opposite, the virgin goddess Artemis, who eschews all forms of sexual expression. And both Hippolytus and his stepmother Phaedra die as a result of their actions. As is typical of Euripides' complex presentation of the human dilemma, however, the play does not offer any easy solution, far less any moral judgment upon either of these two characters. Somewhat oddly, the classical period has left us little evidence of romantic love, although this subject later became central to the Greek novel, a genre which came into being in the late 2nd century BC, roughly, and which we'll be talking about in a later lecture. Turning to the Roman world, few poets have written more viscerally of erotic passion than Catullus. "Vivamus mea lesbia atque amemus. Let us live and love, my lesbia, and value at nothing the rumours that the elderly circulate. Suns can rise and set, but for us, when our brief light has set, there remains the sleep of a single unending night. Give me 1,000 kisses, and then 100 more, and then 1,000, and then 100, and then when we've consummated many thousands, we'll mix them all up, so that we've lost count, and so that no jealous person can envy us knowing how many times we've kissed. Ovid, by contrast, writing somewhat later, mocked the subject mercilessly, the subject of romantic love, in his Ars Amatoria, The Art of Love. Ovid is one of the most fascinating figures in the history of literary sexuality. He was sent into exile by Augustus in AD 8, in part because of what he famously calls Carmen et Error, roughly translatable as the poem and the, well, the mistake. Almost certainly, the poem was The Art of Love. We don't exactly know what the mistake was, but it was probably connected with Augustus's daughter, Julia. As Peter Green has observed, in The Art of Love, Ovid treats women as sexual objects. Time and again, he refers to the object of his desire in the neuter, quod ames, something for you to love. It certainly isn't the Roman equivalent of the Kama Sutra, the Ars Amatoria, because it's all about the art of seduction. There's very little about lovemaking as such. Yet, Ovid's poetry apart, when he was sent into exile by the Emperor Augustus, he wrote very tender love letters to his third wife, to whom he seems to have been devoted. In conclusion, though sex featured very large in the lives and the imaginations of the Greeks and the Romans, it would be wrong to conclude that something as down-to-earth as marital harmony was unknown to them or not seen as worthy of striving towards. Plutarch, circa AD 50 to 120 in particular, wrote a very moving essay entitled Advice on Marriage, a kind of self-help pamphlet containing advice to a young married couple. True, it displays rather more sensitivity to the needs of the husband than it does to those of the wife, and it also takes the highly unfashionable position that it is the husband's duty to tame his wife. The reason for this is that husbands were typically, as I've said, a decade or more older than their wives, both in Greece and in Rome. Even so, Plutarch makes it abundantly clear that a successful marriage must be based on mutual respect, like-mindedness, and goodwill. The Greek words are eidos, the word for shame, actually, which we talked about earlier, homophrosune, and eunoia, respectively. Homophrosune is exactly the quality that Odysseus and Penelope exhibit. Each of them is extremely tricky for one thing, and at the end of the poem, Penelope tricks Odysseus by asking him to move their bed. Only he, as her husband, the one man who has access to their bedroom, knows that it's fashioned out of a living tree. He concludes the essay by declaring that the husband must strive to become, and I'm quoting here from Plutarch, a guide, philosopher, and friend to his wife in all that is most fair and holy. Numerous epitaphs also testify to marital love, though there are rather more such epitaphs purportedly written by wives extolling the virtues of their husbands than vice versa. Mention of epitaphs brings us to the subject of death, which will be the topic of our next lecture. As we will see, attitudes towards death also reflect a particular social reality and are socially constructed, as in the case of sex and sexuality.